Hello there, and a greeting of indeterminate temperature to this, the latest edition of DF Direct Weekly, number 276 by my count. Lots to get through this week. Joining me on the panel, first of all, John Linneman. Hello.
Rich, did you know that it's the 10-year anniversary of Mighty Number 9? It's 10 years old. I just watched a great video from Stop Skeletons from Fighting, our buddy Derek, who was on our Splatterhouse episode. He put out an awesome video kind of looking over it. One of the things I didn't realize is somebody actually ported the game to Vita and 3DS as part of their own Kickstarter project to show that it could be done, since those versions never actually happened. So if you want an incomplete tech demo-y version of the game on those platforms, it's still out there.
Right. Okay, fair enough. But that's somewhat extreme, isn't it?
It is extreme. I agree. But it's cool.
Absolutely. Also joining us, Oliver McKenzie. Hello.
Yes, Rich. And yes, John, I think that would be Unreal Engine 3 on a 3DS. I don't think that's really achievable, but apparently someone's pulled it off in somewhat limited form. That always seemed like a very ambitious goal, and I'm not surprised they didn't manage it, although granted, that project. Oof.
That game, man. That Wii U version especially, my goodness.
Okay, so before we crack on with the Direct proper, quick shout out to digitalfoundry.net, the web-based home of Digital Foundry, curated by Will Judd. Lots going on there this week. DF supporter Speed Lima fixes DLSS 4.5 boiling in Control. That's pretty cool. Sounds like something you should read. he's also talking about updates he's made to his DIY Steam Machine builds, and there's component choices there for both the US and UK markets there. Probably worth thinking about buying some memory. I think that would be my advice. Possibly a graphics card. Maybe some storage before everything gets even worse. He's also talking about analysis of the latest Steam hardware survey, which we're going to be talking about a bit later on in this direct, because it's a bit weird, to say the least. Okay, so our first news story of the week, and it is kind of news as opposed to gaming technology, but out of nowhere, Rockstar has announced that on August 27th, in fact, I'm just going to read the press release as it was sent to me, Grand Theft Auto 6, an extended look, will premiere on Netflix Thursday, August 27th at 3 p.m. ET, and will also launch on the official Rockstar Games YouTube channel and the Grand Theft Auto site, Grand Theft Auto 6 site, at 9 p.m. ET on August 27th. All that's missing is kind of like, thank you for your attention to this matter. That's literally it. Everybody's talking about it, an extended look at Grand Theft Auto 6. Oliver, I'm going to come to you first on this one. Obviously, there's a kind of like a laundry list, a wish list of stuff that we'd like to be in this quote-unquote extended look. It's an extended look, exclusive news here. It's an extended look with capital letters, which is which kind of emphasizes the importance of this. I mean, it's kind of bizarre, isn't it? A 6-hour exclusivity window on Netflix. That's kind of strange.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen something like that before in gaming. Obviously, Rockstar has a pre-existing relationship with Netflix because they distributed the GTA Definitive Edition ports to mobile. I think also the Red Dead Redemption port to mobile phones a little bit ago, right? Not so long ago. So that's certainly a relationship that's been budding, and apparently there's... Yeah, 6-hour exclusivity window, which I think is bizarre. I think in that 6 hours, probably it will become very heavily pirated during that period. I do think this is very welcome, though, on some level, to finally see some extended gameplay, presumably from GTA 6. Again, we don't know anything about it beyond the title, so you just have to presume they're going to show off extended gameplay. I kind of think that maybe that format that has become very popular, the kind of video documentary format we've seen from the likes of Microsoft, for instance, rather recently, I think that might be the format to go with for this one. That would make a lot of sense for me. But at this point, there's no clear evidence as to how long it's going to be. Apparently, a Netflix customer service agent possibly AI agent told someone it would be 20 minutes long, and other people are reading into, like, you know, I clicked play on the video and it showed a time for 30 minutes before it went off, so perhaps it's a 30-minute presentation. Who knows at this point, right? Yeah. It's probably a bit of a crapshoot, but you presume that phrase, an extended look, would imply a bit of a longer runtime than the, like, minute 30 or 2-minute trailers you've seen thus far, which have basically featured cinematic footage. I wouldn't say cutscene footage, because obviously that second trailer was said to have half gameplay and half cutscenes, but the gameplay footage was all presented from a cinematic camera, so it didn't make much of a difference. Can't really tell how a game is going to play from cinematic gameplay footage, right? That's just not how it works. But yeah, they're not disclosing very much at all here. So I am very curious to see how this goes. But one thing I am curious about, and one thing I hope they don't do, is I hope that they air this at 60 frames per second, because we know that cinematic standards are to go for maybe 30 frames per second for footage of this nature, or 24 frames per second. But to really get accurate console-level 60 hertz footage out of this game, even if it's a 30 FPS title, that would be a real treat here, because you've not seen that from prior Rockstar showings either. I believe their previous trailers were encoded at 30 FPS, which made them present a little bit oddly. Actually, they seem to have a bit of some odd, possibly animation stuttering or frame rate stuttering behavior in them, which also aligns with other Rockstar game cutscenes in recent titles, like in GTA 5. Kind of famously, the cutscenes there don't present at a perfectly even cadence necessarily, even on, you know, high-end PCs or consoles. So I'd be curious to see this game running in a 60 hertz container. That would be something I'd really like to see. If not from, like, the Netflix showing, then perhaps from the showing that Rockstar uploads their own website. Perhaps they could encode that at 60 hertz. But yeah, I mean, this is kind of an announcement of an announcement. So there's not really much to go on here. I do hope we see enough from this showing, though, that we're fully sated going into the November release.
Well, that's not going to happen, is it? Realistically, being fully sated, it's, you know, there's always going to be the hunger for more. I mean, you know, yeah, I can kind of see where you're coming from in terms of the presentation for it. I guess you can look at Drive to Survive on Netflix. That seems to be like a mixture of frame rates. They do that's seem true, to yeah. have 60 frames per second stuff in there. So it's not as if the platform is not capable of doing it. It can be done. Yeah, I share basically everything you said there. There's no indication we're actually going to get to see gameplay, but surely at this point they've kind of got to show what the game looks like in terms of what the user experience is going to be. Having said that, you know, basically they've got a captive audience of hundreds of millions of people, so they can show what the hell they want, really. Is that's the case, isn't it? There's still like several months to go until the game's out. So, yeah. John, is there anything specific that you're looking for from this presentation? I mean, apart from the game.
Well, I mean, firstly, I think the thing that fascinates me so much is the fact that people are getting so excited and talking and arguing over essentially a commercial. Yes. So it's like, it's so fun to me to see people like, oh my God, this commercial, it's going to debut. Like, it's, I mean, I get it. It's not different than like trailers and whatever, but, and that's kind of what we do with game shows, but I never really think about it from that perspective. But if you step back, now that it's on something like Netflix, it really made me stop and think like, oh shoot, like we're like regularly getting hyped for what are basically just commercials. Yep. So, but showing it on Netflix is certainly different. I guess the main thing I'm curious about is, while I've always said, you know, Netflix compared to say like a proper UHD Blu-ray is worse, I do think Netflix does in general produce better image quality than what I see on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Although they obviously have more control. So that can also just be a matter of the content creators putting up lower quality stuff on on YouTube. So the quality here could be quite good. And as you noted, it does support 50 and 60 frames per second video playback. There are programs on there, especially sports related things, that do offer that. So it's hard to say, but I think ultimately that's going to be up to Rockstar. Rockstar is going to be the one that gives Netflix this file, this data, and then Netflix is going to basically just show what they've been given. So if they're given a 4K 30 FPS video, that's what's going to appear, I would assume. So And I, man, what a great deal for Rockstar, though. Like, you can bet that Netflix paid a boatload of money for this.
What for a 6-hour exclusivity window?
Right, exactly. And it's really interesting. I it's so unprecedented. I'm genuinely just fascinated by the whole business around this. And GTA 6 might be the biggest game ever in terms of, like, the hype cycle.
Yeah, so fair point.
Mm-hmm. And I it does feel that way. It's a really interesting point. It's just, I feel like this is the kind of release where you just have to take it for what it is, and just, it is its own thing. It has its own orbit. This is all, GTA 6 is almost its own platform, so to speak. Right. Any data that you extract from the success of GTA 6, I think, cannot really be applied to anything else. This is what it is. This is the Avengers Endgame kind of thing of the game world, since given how big that was financially. It's just a crazy situation. So, but I do hope that, I would like to see one of those videos where they essentially walk the viewer through the types of things you can do in the game world. Yeah. And I have a feeling there's going to be a lot, like, kind of harkening back to, like, San Andreas in a way, but, like, not actually that, but the idea is, like, you had GTA 3, then Vice City, and then San Andreas. They built upon that and just, like, exploded in terms of stuff you could do. GTA 6 is kind of like the second San Andreas in a way. It's like the third of the HD era of Grand Theft Autos, if you will, since right. they massively altered, like, the core of the way the games were made. So, I don't like to always fall into hype cycles like this, but I have to admit I'm very curious, and I do actually admittedly love GTA 5. I think it's a great game. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I actually replayed the whole thing not too long ago on the PC with the maximum possible graphics, and it's still an interesting single player experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, something that comes up on my Twitter timeline a lot, and I really like it. I welcome it when it appears in the For You tab, which is quite an achievement, bearing in mind some of the stuff that appears there. It's the stuff where, basically, years on from release, Red Dead Redemption 2, there's kind of like systemic things in the game engine that just speak to the amount of work that went into creating that game world. Oh, it's over-engineered to a significant degree, to the point where you just see things that people are finding within the game years later. You know, interesting physics interactions, you know, that sort of thing. Observations of the game world. So, you know, apply that to the city that we're going to be seeing in Grand Theft Auto 6, but next generation visuals, you know, probably next generation simulation, that kind of thing. I really hope that we actually get to see some of that thinking, you know, the amount of work that goes into creating that world. Because, you're kind of just getting hints of it so far in the trailers, and we've kind of like come up with our own thoughts on that base so far, based on what we've seen so far. But yeah, we really want to see more. We want to see what they've been up to. What's the vision here, ultimately, for Grand Theft Auto 6? So I'm fascinated to see what they're going to come up with for this. However, something that is concerning, I think it's something you touched on a bit there, John, is basically everything we've seen with Grand Theft Auto 6 so far has been viewed through the lens of what Rockstar wants to give us, and some sort of preview cycle where other people might actually get to look at the game and play it. That would be quite good, wouldn't it? It's a crazy thought, but maybe that's something they might consider. And I guess in the past we've seen things like they were kind of like the GQ articles on prior Rockstar games that were quite interesting, but at least some sort of access and some sort of different viewpoint, some sort of, dare I say it, editorial would be great. And I'm curious to know what they're going to be doing in the run-up to launch on this. Are we actually going to get review code? There have been some various rumors about this, about press events and stuff, which I don't think is the best way to do it. But I can imagine that they may well do it, bearing in mind the kind of lengths that they seem to be going to contain leaks. I don't think that's particularly great, but I guess we'll need to see what's going to happen and hopefully get some official word from Rockstar, because they're in this sort of position now where, you can contact them and you've got no idea if you're going to get a response or not to your questions because, you know, they're so guarded about this game. And I guess basically, you know, the future of the business probably relies on it. So it's probably not surprising that they are extremely protective of it. But at the same time, you know, some sort of discovery of what's actually happening in the game, a different perspective, you know, actual editorial, I think would be something they should be considering. Even if they want to sort of, do curated previews, that sort of thing, that's not unknown. I am concerned about the review aspect of it, though. It's certainly an interesting way to market what is looking like the biggest game ever. Certainly in terms of like comparable movies, I'm thinking that the trailer side of things, I'm just going back to the episode one trailer for Star Wars way back in the day. I mean, that was such a huge event. And I guess maybe Grand Theft Auto 6 is in a sort of similar league to that.
You're saying this is going to be like GTA's episode one?
Well, in terms of the trailer hype, but hopefully not the final result.
Yeah. Now, one thing interesting that you mentioned, Rich, was those details that people love to bring up in Red Dead 2. And I'm curious to see if that ends up being the case with GTA 6, because I've noticed a huge trend lately where people are very angry at those types of details online. And I think it's born out of the increase in cost of computing and like the general unaffordability of things, the amount of development time things are taking. So like people went from being amazed and impressed with those sorts of details to being angry and blaming them, even though they often don't understand them and get mad at the wrong thing. But there's a lot of pushback to it, I would say. Right. And I'm wondering if that will be extended to Rockstar, if people say that's why it took this long to make, or if Rockstar essentially will get away with it and people will just love those details. I suspect the latter, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't think Rockstar particularly cares, because
they don't care.
You know, untold millions of copies, and you know, I think that's probably something that they should be applauded for. They've delayed this game several times because it's not ready, right? And the fact that they have delayed it and not sort of cashed in on an incomplete game, I think that's something to be applauded. I guess the litmus test will be the state of the game when it actually ships.
Right. I just can't imagine working on a game like this, man. Like the scope and the expectations, like the pressure of working on GTA 6 has to be so immense. I really feel for the guys doing this, because this is just so much, and so much is riding on it. And they know it.
The other thing about the sort of systemic videos that we've seen online for Red Dead is that it's become kind of like the comparison point for other games on much smaller budgets, and the fact that they're not able to produce the same level of fidelity in the game world. And they, you know, people are sort of berating modern games produced on different budget levels without all of the money available in the world, which Rockstar basically has for its games. And I think it's sort of unfair comparisons. There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah. But,
you know, I guess it is what it is.
And conversely, when a title does manage to exceed Red Dead Redemption 2 in one key aspect, like arguably Crimson Desert did with its, I would say, the river physics, the physics of the flowing water through rivers and enclosed spaces in that game, looked really sublime. There's a lot of celebration and excitement in some quarters for what that represents. And I kind of feel like GTA 6 might be, I don't want to say the last hurrah, but certainly a big hurrah for AAA gaming, because it is, you know, as marketed by Rockstar up until this point, it is a single player only title. They're not talking about multiplayer at all. It's does not appear to be a live service title. It has some pre-order bonuses, but I mean, it seems to be a fully contained single player package from day one. It is not a massive platform. It might become a platform in the future with the addition of multiplayer mode, but for now, it's just a big, gigantic, extremely expensive single player AAA title that people are going to buy once, play through, enjoy. That's the kind of model that is kind of on its way out, maybe, in the broader video game landscape. But Rockstar kind of still manages to make it work, and presumably will still manage to make it work for an enormous profit. So I think that's also just very exciting to see the most AAA of the AAA, quadruple A, quintuple A, whatever you want to call it. Right? It's really exciting on that level.
John, how many A's does GTA 6 have? Like, maybe we'll find out on August 27th.
Quintuple A for this one. It's got to be.
Quintuple. I mean,
it's tough to go beyond, you know, the Ubisoft masterpiece.
Skull and Bones.
Skull and Bones. But I think they might be able to pull it off.
Well, you know, the anticipation around this is absolutely galactic at this point. And, you know, certainly from our perspective, you know, we sort of love new gaming technology, and every Rockstar release is basically a milestone. So, yeah, kind of amused by the circus surrounding this and this six hour. Surely, John, if money changed hands, they could have got more than a 6 hour exclusivity window, because that's not a lot of time, is it?
I mean, this stuff doesn't come cheap, man. Rockstar can ask what they want, and Netflix is probably like, oh, we got $1 billion here. That's good for maybe 6 hours.
I was thinking back to all the rumors that were surrounding when Cyberpunk 2077 got a trailer at the Xbox showcase at one of the E3s. I can't remember which one. And there were sort of talks of CD Projekt Red being given $10 million or something. And it turned out it was like $0 based on our sort of behind the scenes investigation. It's just they wanted people to see the game. I mean, it's just sort of just goes to show the amount of hype that goes on there. Anyway, we're certainly caught up in the hype, and we'll be checking out this event on August 27th. We're going to be at Gamescom, though, John, which we're probably going to have to have a look at our calendar to see how this slots in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we could wait several hours, unlike a lot of people seemingly who will be subscribing to Netflix to see it.
I can wait roughly 6 hours, no problem.
Okay, let's move on. Okay, so we're trying to keep things positive here after a whole bunch of negativity over the past few weeks. And this week we did have QuakeCon. QuakeCon happened. It's happening now. There's a lot of stuff which we'd like to talk about, which I guess we'll have to talk about in the next Direct, because it's yet to happen. For example, all of the key id Software principles from back in the day are coming together. But John, some stuff that we want to talk about here. Obviously, we have already examined the Dawn of the Machine mission pack for Quake to celebrate the 30th anniversary. But yeah,
I kind of wanted to acknowledge that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, technically, I guess the 30th anniversary already passed in June, was it? But this is like the big celebration for it, and it's cool. I mean, John Romero there, John Carmack's there. We're going to see all the old id guys get together over the weekend, I think, to talk. But there was already an awesome stream where John Romero was up there with Marty Stratton and a couple other fellows talking about the Dawn of the Machine release, kind of playing through it. And I love the commentary, listening to John Romero talk about new stuff created for Quake by other people. And you can just see he has this love and like just thought process around Quake that's just fascinating to explore. And this real appreciation for what people have done. And it's amazing. Like, really, Quake, we've done so many videos on Quake over the years, and for a good reason, because it is just, the more I think about it, there's many reasons why I think it's possibly one of, if not the most important games ever made. You know, like, when you really break it down, you think about all the different aspects, right? The game itself, yes, amazing. But it was also the game that essentially started the online multiplayer revolution for shooters and built all of those like big conventions and tournaments and all, like so much of that stuff originated from Quake. It was the game that really allowed modding to thrive. Like, there was mods for Wolfenstein and of course Doom, but like the leap in quality and what was possible in Quake, like id specifically, and John Romero even talks about that again. They made Quake with this in mind. They knew people liked to make stuff for their games and they wanted to really push it. And they implemented systems that basically made that possible. And then the Quake engine itself went on to become hugely licensed and served as the backbone for so many other engines and games. And I mean, it basically gave us Half-Life. It gave us Call of Duty and so many others. Like, so many things started from Quake. And the fact that people are still playing it today, it's still beloved. There's so many source ports out there. They released the source code, which was a great practice that id used to do. And as I noted in my video, like the idea that a company like Machine Games was willing to spend resources to just create a pack for a game like this, it's not selling a new product. It's a product that's already been on sale for years.
Yeah.
This version, but they're just like, yeah, we want to make new stuff for it. And they did. Yep. And I think that really is an awesome thing that says a lot about, you know, just the love that this game has. And every time I sit down and play it, I'm just amazed at how good it still is. Like, I, considering, I think John said, and when they were talking about it, it was like technically like 7 months of development for the game. Like, obviously, development went way longer than that because all the research and building the engine and figuring out what they're going to do. But as far as like what they ended up doing, they didn't actually have that much time to make it. And yet it's so, it's just, it feels great. Just the control, the player movement, the way everything moves. Like still today, it's just one of the most satisfying to play shooters ever made. I also, John went into some stories about how they met up with Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails. And they actually had a little segment in there where Trent talks about his experience doing that. And it's just, I love it because it was really just a case of like, he was a fan of id Software's games and they were a fan of his, and they had like some kind of shared manager relationship, but they were able to, just able to link up and just hang out and like, wouldn't it be cool if we did this?
Right.
And they did it. And I love that kind of stuff. And it's still iconic. So, man, every time I think about Quake, I'm just, it's just awesome. Another point, and I mentioned a lot of this in my DF Retro on it, but that I forgot, but Quake was also arguably one of the biggest games for pushing the rise of 3D acceleration.
Yes.
Where
I was there.
You were there. You had a rendition verite, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've told that story before, how basically I was mugged off by John Carmack. He did this support for the rendition verite. And I was like, you know, it was pretty good. It looked obviously, you know, a world apart from the software rendered version. And then everything shifted to 3DFX and the OpenGL mini driver. And I realized that I'm going to have to buy a new graphics card.
The thing is, Rich, when I did that video, I actually bought a rendition card and I played VQuake for it. And I actually think VQuake looks a lot better than GLQuake in a 3DFX.
Wow.
Because it's just, it retains more of like the flavor of the software render, but adding in hardware features. Whereas on a Voodoo, I feel like, and it's more because they went with a more generic OpenGL approach, they had to like compromise on things like the way they handled water, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's just like a warping mesh instead of like that cool texture effect and various other changes like that. Plus, on the Verite, you can actually run it at a lower resolution if you want. Yeah. And I actually think that really benefits the griminess of Quake's graphics. It just looks really cool that way. The problem with the Verite, as I discovered, and we'll get to this later when I talk about some retro PC stuff, but I'm reminded the 2D performance of the Verite card is horrible. So like if you want to play other games like or that are not 3D accelerated, like it's really, really bad at that. So like the card was cool in some ways, but it was very limited in others.
Quake, it's probably one of my favorite games of all time, maybe even my favorite full stop. I mean, you think about Doom and that was the game that changed everything, right? But the game that sits in my heart as the sort of all-time classic for multiplayer gaming specifically was Quake, right? Because the experiences we had there back in the day, and it was just astonishing in a way that I don't think Doom quite matched, even though that was like, you know, that was just a total game changer. First time I played Doom multiplayer was actually at Virgin Interactive in South California. Yeah, basically the concept of networking together PCs at that point when Doom came out was kind of like something I didn't really understand. But by the time Quake came along, it was kind of a bit more established. And the mechanics of multiplayer Quake are virtually perfect, I think. And the other thing about it is that I can't get on with multiplayer games today because basically there seems to be period where game comes out and everyone is on a level playing field, but then you arrive maybe a few days later and you're left behind. It's very, very difficult for a newcomer. And also all of the mechanics that are in there, it's kind of almost overwhelming. In terms of an immediate multiplayer game that you understand immediately, that plays brilliantly to this day, I mean, you could give me any multiplayer game, and I would, and if you gave me the choice to play that and or Quake with buddies, it's an all-timer, right? There's nothing like it.
I agree.
And you know, it's my forever game, I think, because it's perfect in ways that I don't think anybody else can match. Maybe some of that is down to nostalgia, but it's just such a great experience. And the accessibility is still there. I mean, you can play it path-faced, as we did back in the day, a few years back, right? And that's a nice new way to experience multiplayer Quake, but it is still multiplayer Quake. And something we did, the guys I was working with back in, like, you know, 1996, you know, when the Night Dive remaster came out, we sort of got back together and started playing multiplayer Quake, you know, maybe one night for in a month. And, you know, all of those memories came back. It was just absolutely phenomenal. And kudos, of course, to Night Dive for producing that sort of modern version, which, you know, really stands up. It's brilliant stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty good, I would say. The only thing I would critique, and it actually got a little bit worse here, is that that specific version has issues with how interpolation works. So like character camera movement looks kind of jittery. There's very specific ways to get around it involving like setting the game's frame rate cap at exactly your refresh rate, but disabling VSync in Windows, yet using the in-game one or something like that. And if you don't do that, it ends up looking kind of jittery in a weird way. And it actually kind of got worse with the latest patch. It's very weird. I really hope they can fix that. It basically means that while the mouse movement looks like it's high frame rate, the actual player character movement looks closer to like 60. So, but there are ways to solve it at least. But yeah, like there's memories though you gave, like networked Quake. For me, it was at my high school. Since I got in trouble for sort of bypassing some school security stuff, and got put in front of the guy managing the computer lab, and then he ended up saying, rather than getting mad, he's like, hey, you want to like volunteer here and help me out? So
right,
me and a buddy, we basically, you know, we became tight with the computer lab guy, and that also meant that we could come into the lab, you know, on off times and use it for whatever we wanted. So we would do like networked Quake in there, and it was a good old time. But yeah, the thing about Quake multiplayer, I guess for me, is just I just like a game where the only leveling up you do is your own personal skill.
Yes.
You're not collecting weapons. You're not collecting things. The weapons themselves are in the map. You have to find them. And that just leads to some fun strategies. Just the shift towards loadouts and leveling and gear. And I know a lot of people love it, but it just never worked for me. And that's it's a bummer.
Yeah, loadouts I'm not a fan of at all. I mean, basically, it's fine if you've got a big bunch of time to play games and you can experiment with all of these different configurations. But, you know, I don't. And so it's kind of almost counterproductive in terms of like bringing me into a game from that perspective.
One last thing I want to mention before we move on, though, is, actually a couple little things. First of all, Evercade, they announced a Doom version of the Nexus. So it's their new version of the Evercade coming out. It's like the more premium model with a better screen and it's a bit larger size. They're actually doing a Doom collection for that, which I think is cool. And also, I noticed on the site, they noted that for the very first time, Return to Castle Wolfenstein is now available here in Germany, uncut and uncensored. So the history of Germany and like violence and symbolism and stuff in games is so wild. I should do a video on that someday, but like Turok, Half-Life, so many other games, all the enemies are replaced with robots. Yep. And, you know, in Half-Life, the scientist, if you shot them rather than dying, they would just like sit down on the ground, stuff like that.
What?
Yeah. Like they, you couldn't kill them. You would shoot them and then they would just like sit down.
Right. Okay. That is utterly bizarre.
But utterly yes, bizarre. QuakeCon was cool.
Okay. Yes, QuakeCon was cool, but something else happened this week, and Oliver, we need to talk about this. Basically, there's a video from Alf Einbier, Well Played, What Happened at id Software When the Layoffs Hit, featuring Chris Hayes. Chris Hayes works at id Software to this day. He was a survivor of the layoffs there. And basically, a prominent union member, seemingly, because he feels empowered enough to actually go on the record in what was a 90-minute interview to describe actually what happened when the layoffs hit recently at id Software. And I would describe it as a harrowing tale. What do you think?
Yeah, it's pretty miserable, to be honest. I mean, just the way the cuts were handled within the studio, like the fact that they were just told, you know, don't come in today, and then people were assigned to two calls, and you know what that means. One call gets the bad news, one call gets the okay news, or at least the you're staying news. And the fact they weren't informed of who was leaving specifically, they had to piece it together themselves. They've still apparently not been told exactly what they're going to be doing in terms of adapting to their reduced scope, because about half of the positions at id were eliminated, unfortunately, in this round. There were some cuts they expected, apparently, internally, but they were only expecting, you know, maybe 10% of positions to be eliminated. Instead, they walked away with about half of positions being eliminated. And the staffing level the studio is being left with, especially with respect to like specific disciplines, like when you look at their infrastructure team, apparently that was wiped out basically. He mentioned their skybox artist was fired. So who does skyboxes? I don't know. And then of course, famously on the engine side, they're left with very few individuals there to continue working in id Tech. It just sounds completely miserable. And I think he makes a really good point in that the studio might be around the same size as they were when they did Doom 2016. But the scale of game dev has increased massively, and a studio the size of id really can't hope to complete large games with anything like the staffing level. You know, maybe they can integrate more external devs, but at the same time as Microsoft is doing this, Microsoft is also saying they want to decrease their vendor and contractor spend by like 50%, right? So who knows exactly where that's headed. And of course, he makes the point that id was really well integrated as a studio. You know, the vast majority of people who were working there were working for, you know, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. I think he said a majority of people who are working on Doom the Dark Ages, on Doom the Dark Ages and its DLC, had also worked on Doom 2016 and Doom Eternal. So that's, you know, pretty heavy continuity of service in an industry where people don't actually work for that long. So yeah, exactly what motivated these cuts, I don't know. He kind of offers some speculation there. But it is a really unfortunate situation. And it just seems like so horrible to do this. Really horrible to do this to a studio like this. And at the same time, it does not really feel like Microsoft has a totally clear plan here. At least not a plan that's been articulated to, you know, studio membership at id, or to people who are outside of maybe management. Even still, doesn't really seem like management has a good handle on things, nor is management able to do too much, because as this individual says, management seems to be getting running orders from Microsoft. They don't have a lot of independent ability to manage overall staffing levels, things like this. They're basically told what to do. They have to carry out those orders, and there's not a whole lot of truly independent management left at Bethesda or id anymore, which is very unfortunate as well. So yeah, it just seems like a really awful situation, and I really do feel for them, because it really feels like they're in the crosshairs. Any studio who ships a game, you know, they were a day before they were going to ship the Revelations DLC, and they just all got, you know, a huge portion of them got laid off. And I just think that's just a pattern that's emerging within Microsoft, these layoffs immediately following or immediately preceding a major game release.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking stuff. I mean, Chris is basically suggesting that the layoffs were illegal, and there should have been negotiations with the union. Microsoft has their own interpretation of that. Chris was also talking about the difficulties they actually have arranging time to negotiate with Microsoft. Because, you know, basically they roll up saying, okay, we can spare you an hour at this particular day. And it's just not enough time to actually discuss the issue there. I mean, I've just sort of put together a list of some of the stuff which I heard and in this particular interview, which is shocking. It was so humane. It was demoralizing. Morale has never been lower. Yeah, I mean, it just goes on. The description of the, as you were talking about, the way that employees were kind of like sent into two different calls where no one was allowed to have camera or audio, no names were showing up. So, you know, they didn't even know who was affected one way or the other. It took kind of like, oh, and the scramble to actually share contact details with other members of staff after that, because it was extremely difficult. There's the discussion about the fact that there doesn't seem to be a coherent plan or vision for id Software moving forward. Suggestions that Microsoft doesn't seem to understand game development. And Chris was saying he believes it's hard to develop a AAA game with half the people, but by hard, I mean impossible because of the indiscriminate nature of the cuts. It just goes on and on and on. Erosion of trust, long-term damage to id's culture attributed to Microsoft. Even if a magic wand was waved and everyone got their jobs back, plenty of people have lost their trust and they will never trust Microsoft again. They'll never work for a Microsoft studio again. And obviously there were some choice words for Microsoft and it, the way it sort of views games. Chris was saying that they don't understand games, art, or how studios create value. Shocking stuff there. I mean, it's a 90-minute interview. There's a lot to go through there. And it's fair to say that the beginning of the interview is actually... Chris is talking about his personal experiences in becoming a part of id Software and how it was the kind of company that was so good to work at. You know, a lot of guys there wanted to stay there until they retired. It was a really interesting interview, but also very, very sad. There's also sort of comments about... the fact they had no performance metrics to work to. You know, they had no bar for success. It was just completely opaque. And the kind of issues that Game Pass throws up, you know, because obviously game sales will be lower because of Game Pass. That's a given, right? But, you know, how does that filter into metrics that define success or failure of a project? I could go on here. I suggest watching the interview because it's really, really illuminating. And I think there's still the sort of sense that the union are trying to do something about this, but there seems to be a lot of friction going on here in actually producing an equitable process there. John, did you catch this interview?
Yeah, I watched it. I mean, I don't want to get too much into it. It was kind of sad to see indeed, but it does kind of suggest that, as I suspected, Microsoft's taking the usual quote unquote tech bro approach, which is just move fast and break things, which I feel like is working increasingly less these days, where they just make a big mess and then worry about the aftermath later. But right. The aftermath in this case has pretty nasty side effects. So all I can say is I hope that something like they could find a way out. I don't even know. I will say the rest of the employees that are still there, including Chris, I hope that they're able to get back on their feet and still create things together and that the studio culture can recover somehow. But I feel so bad for all the other people let go. I mean, these guys were performing at such a high level. It really shows that there's just like there's no amount of success that can truly guarantee longevity, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, shocking stuff. I mean, I don't really want to dwell too much more on this because we have discussed the topic before. But the reason we're talking about this particular interview is that this is like firsthand information from somebody that's willing to come forward and tell everyone exactly what happened and go on the record about it. And I think Chris deserves kudos for that.
Yep.
But let's move on. Right, so it's been a bit of a lean week for news, and it was quite interesting to see that The Verge broke cover, basically confirming what we kind of know to be true anyway. But basically, it looks like, thanks to the leak of specific internal Microsoft documents, it is now pretty much certain that Xbox 360 games are going to be coming to PC. And the disc-to-digital program that we've also reported about in the past, that is also set to happen possibly sooner rather than later, maybe even next month, which would be very, very interesting. I'm going to go to you first on this one, John. Xbox 360 games on PC, it seems to be tied into some sort of next generation drive. A gradual rollout between 2027 and 2028 across next generation devices. Curious stuff, right?
I mean, this does kind of sound like they're just laying the groundwork for their next machine, which, you know, if we know, given what we know about Helix, is very PC kind of focused in the back end. So it makes sense that they would be developing a way to enjoy your back catalog library on newer, different hardware. And I guess that's one thing I can say about Microsoft's approach here is I respect that they've continued to kind of pursue this, ensuring that the library that you've built can be taken with you. And I think that that is a good thing. And I am, even though I'm not a fan of the digital model that much, if you're going to do it, this is at least one good, this is a good example of how to do it well, I suppose, in that, you know, you're honoring people's purchases and their library years later, even on wildly different hardware, including the PC now, which is super cool. So I'll be curious to see how well this works, because what we've already learned from the initial four original Xbox games is that by bringing this to the PC, it opens Pandora's box for people to tinker with it. And we've already seen Conquer, for instance, be updated with like widescreen 60 FPS, things like this. The community is finding ways to do that. At least now with these things coming to PC, so to speak, this does kind of open the door for more mods like this, and it could really enhance a lot of these classic games. So I'm eager to see where that goes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Oliver, what do you think about this?
I think this is good. Very expected, obviously, given the recent development of the Xbox original backwards compatibility. But I think this is pretty cool. Some of the details here are a little bit intriguing to me, though. Like, The Verge is suggesting that the availability and pricing of these games on PC might differ according to the publishers of these games, because they can kind of set their own rubrics for what availability might look like on the PC platform and what pricing might look like on the PC platform. In theory, those things might diverge somewhat. In practice, who knows? We'll have to see. But yeah, I mean, I would really love to see at least the full suite of enhancements that we saw on Xbox Series brought over to PC, because obviously there you had 4K support, you had 60 FPS support in some titles, high frame rate support in some titles. That would be really cool. I'd love to play through like Final Fantasy 13 on PC with some of these enhancements, though who knows exactly what that would look like. Maybe they'll come up with some official remaster or something at some point as well. But, you know, I think it's good. It's very welcome. Makes a lot of sense with Helix. Really has to happen. Kind of surprising it didn't happen sometime in the intervening, like, 11 years or something, the past 11 years, when Microsoft has had this right. capability on Xbox One consoles, but has not brought it to PC, but better late than ever, right?
The thing that sort of baffles me at the moment about this is the extent to which this emulator is like for Helix, or whether it's for PC, or whether it's for both. Because you'd think that the existing Xbox emulators that exist for Xbox Series consoles, they should just work on Helix, right? You know, they should just carry over in the same way that we kind of expected the Xbox One emulators to carry over to Xbox Series. You know, it seemed to be a sort of similar experience, just with acceleration on the Series side. And then you had the FPS boost and resolution boost initiatives that Microsoft added on top of that. So, you know, it still sort of raises questions in my mind of what Helix actually is. Is it a transition to Windows? Is it going to retain the kind of curated Xbox area that is more console-like? Is it a kind of hybrid of the two? I'm not really sure. But the other thing I think, which is a slight worry for me, is that, you know, I applaud the notion of being able to bring across digital purchases across the Xbox generations. But are you going to be able to transition those games over to the PC side of things if you're still in that within that Xbox ecosystem? First party games, I suspect so, right? Because Microsoft has full control there outside of the games that have licensing problems, you know, the Project Gotham Racings, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if I own Xbox Series versions of third party games, if I own a bunch of Xbox 360 games that are also available on PC, via Steam or whatever, what happens? Are those games going to become available? I kind of want them to, even though I could probably pick up the same games for, you know, next to nothing on Steam. I kind of want to be able to not have piecemeal access to my Xbox digital library, which, you know, is quite substantial at this point. But I'd kind of like to be able to, you know, bring those versions over as well. And I'm wondering where the sort of what the actual end result is going to be, because the support for backwards compatibility on Xbox Series X is, I mean, it's by no means complete, but it's pretty decent, right? Would you agree with that, John? But the concept we might not be able to get that entire library on the PC side does make me, you know, a bit sad.
I mean, it is what it is with that stuff, right? It's just,
yeah,
they're beholden to certain limitations, licenses, whatever. But mm-hmm. again, maybe there's this possibility of them opening up by bringing any of this stuff to the PC. It potentially opens up the gate to modifying it to support other software, maybe. You know, imagine injecting games that are maybe not intentionally supported. Because I say that because I think it's Xenia or whatever the Xbox 360 emulator is on PC now, it still has a lot of limitations. It's pretty far behind our PC S3, I would say. So I think Microsoft's emulation does better overall based on what we've seen. I mean, we can only test the officially supported games, but it does seem better overall. So I would love to see Project Gotham injected into this thing, for instance.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be really, really cool. There was other things in the Verge report there. Basically, a timescale was put to the Project Positron disk-to-digital feature. This basically means that you'll be able to use the individual ID that's printed on every single Xbox disk to sort of translate that disk into a digital entity that you can add to your digital library, which I think is probably the best situation for a pretty bad situation with the end of disks. But the news there was basically that it was initially decided that there would be a public beta for July with general availability set for August. That didn't happen, but I suspect it's probably not too far behind. So maybe it will happen in, you know, with a beta in August and wide availability shortly thereafter. I think that's really interesting. I really want to see how that works. We've also had quite a lot of interest in whether Sony is able to do exactly the same thing, because obviously Sony has broken cover and said that it is basically the end of disc-based software on the PlayStation from 2028 onwards. And so, you know, I tried to look into this and to see whether there is a sort of equivalent sort of per disc ID on the PlayStation side. Now, the thing is, there is this thing called the PS Dev Wiki, and basically it tells you everything, every element that is on a particular PlayStation disc. And I've got to say that there is nothing on there that overtly suggests that there is an individual serial number per disc that would enable a disc-to-digital program on the Sony side. That's not to say it's not possible, because obviously Sony knows more about its discs than anybody else. But this information here, it's pretty detailed. And if you sort of piece together everything that's in there, I think the best you could do is probably maybe sort of like individually identifying particular batches of discs that may have come from individual machines within the factory. But the concept that every disc is readily identifiable and able to be turned into a digital purchase, probably not going to happen, but I'd love to see it if it is true. What do you think about this, Oliver?
I think the route Sony will go down, I wouldn't bet money on this, but I think the route Sony will go down is to ship a disk drive with PS6, but not a disk drive that ships with the unit. disk drive that you attach optionally to the unit, maybe via a cable, maybe via some kind of more integrated attachment, who knows. But my suspicion is that the way that Sony will tackle this looming digital disk crisis, because I think it is a big problem for them potentially, is to basically use the same solution they've done for PS5, which I think works reasonably well. I think the framework for Microsoft's whole tech stack here is really the infamous digital non-lending whatever practices they had going on with the and the online authentication practices they had going on that were planned for the initial launch of the Xbox One, and perhaps those signatures have allowed them to do this kind of program with some technical work. But yeah, I really do suspect that this is Microsoft's way of accommodating that, Microsoft's soft way of signaling, hey, the next console won't have a disk drive. For Sony, I think they made their announcement to preempt publishers leaking it, perhaps, and they don't have a kind of comparative, similar story to tell PlayStation gamers about the future of PlayStation discs on PSX. Though I think it kind of behooves them at this point to come up with some kind of story that they can sell to consumers that will placate them to some degree, because people are very upset. But I see mostly online, I don't know what you think about this, John, but mostly I've seen fairly positive reactions to this Positron stuff from gamers online. They seem reasonably pleased by it because it doesn't really take away options for them at the moment. It only expands their capabilities to use their disk entitlements, turn them into digital entitlements, potentially for future consoles. That seems to be received cautiously, but positively as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably about right. It's not about taking away options so far. It's about potentially offering more options. And I think that's, again, respectable to do this. It's an interesting approach. Yeah, especially like when you start to consider the variety of hardware that they've expanded their services to, there are certain platforms where simply a disk just isn't possible. And this suddenly makes playing that type of software actually possible, which I think there is value to that. And it just ties into this whole way of thinking where Microsoft does actually seem to care about accessing your library going forward, which is important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Yeah, looking forward to this proposed beta test for the Positron stuff, hopefully coming soon. But let's move on. Right then, Half-Life Alyx, it is and remains one of the greatest VR experiences ever made. And John, you've seen something rather interesting that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, so there's somebody that goes by the name AMP Game Dev that released a video showing super early experiments with Half-Life Alyx running natively on a Quest 3. Now, I would say, as the comments kind of suggested, it's more like walking as opposed to running. It's not playable, really. It's very, very choppy still, but it is still, like, there is progress being made. And essentially what they're doing is it's sort of like they're using Winlater XR to sort of translate a Windows software to Android, in addition to like Proton plus FEX. So it's like a bunch of tricks to sort of get a Windows game running on an Android-based ARM system. I guess it's sort of like a proof of concept thing that shows that standalone Alyx could potentially exist, I would say, on the Steam frame. You know, where it, you know, this type of work, Valve, I think, would be able to make greater changes to it to allow this to run better, and they could modify things to support it. But it does show that it could technically possibly be done. The main limitation he notes here is that the Quest's 8 gigabytes of shared memory isn't enough for the game, basically. So many of the maps just can't be loaded right now. But again, this is just the work of somebody sort of playing around with different layers of the game, trying to get it to go. And I'm just happy to see like actual attempts being done for this. And I really hope this does lead to the Steam frame eventually having some sort of a native version of this game running. I feel like it could be possible. hard, difficult, but possible. I hope so. Because I do still, I still think Half-Life Alyx is one of, it's a very rare game where we got to see all the might of Valve poured into like a really high-end VR experience. And there's just so many interesting design elements in that game that are still just so fun to go through. I love replaying Half-Life Alyx for that reason. It's just a brilliant, brilliant game. And I think I would love it even more if it was available on a standalone headset like that. I guess saying love it even more, it's more like it would just be something that's cool to see, and it would also allow more people to experience it, I think.
Interesting.
I'm not convinced that they'll actually, this guy will ever get this running smooth on a regular Quest 3. Like, that feels like beyond, like, they would have to make pretty serious architectural changes to the game to do it. Like, I think you could get some version of this working with enough effort and enough changes, but as is, I think it's just too much, especially with the memory requirements. But still, it's cool.
Oliver, I seem to recall that obviously, you visited Valve. You've seen the Steam fame. You're an advantage to all of us here. And I believe that Valve's emphasis was basically more on the Steam fame as a streaming device for VR, as opposed to like running native experiences. But it can run native experiences. And I think, obviously, it would be great if Alyx could run on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, their emphasis for sure, especially for more demanding 3D titles, is to run them using streaming from a PC system. That's the definite takeaway from the coverage on SteamFrame that I did. And my experiences at Valve, indeed, I did see Half-Life Alyx running on the headset, but it was being streamed at a very high frame rate, looked very good, great image quality, no complaints there. And I suspect that's the optimal way to play Half-Life Alyx, assuming you have a suitable PC system. But Valve did say, actually, to us in a comment that I think we received prior to the publication of our content, but they did comment to us that Half-Life Alyx is a great experience when streamed from PC to Steam Frame, as I suggested earlier, but that they're also looking into making it a good standalone experience as well. And I think that's the only comment that we received, as well as the only substantive comment that anyone received on the matter. So I think, at least judging from that statement, they are, or at least they were, trying to get it working on Steam Frame in a standalone fashion. But I think that maybe they did not have a high degree of confidence, or just did not know how that effort would go. I think when you look at the minimum requirements of a game like Half-Life Alyx, it really wants a GPU in the kind of like GTX 1060 or RX 580 range, or kind of like that bare minimum VR range that we see bandied about, talking about kind of mid-range GPUs from, you know, 2016, 2017, somewhere in that vicinity, to get your game running well on Steam Frame. When you actually look at what this hardware is delivering, it probably falls well below that standard. So you're really looking at much more mobile VR software that would be more suitable for the Steam Frame. Titles that would natively work well on a device like the Quest 3 to begin with, right? That'll probably be more suitable for Steam Frame in general. So yeah, I do think Valve is working on this. I would not want to extrapolate too much from the Quest 3, though, because the Steam Frame has a much more capable SoC. It has 12 gigabytes of RAM. It should be able to deliver a substantially better experience. And of course, you have all the Valve optimization effort at its heels, which could really improve that experience all the more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, looking at things more strategically, what really interests me about the Steam Frame beyond the VR stuff is that FX translation layer. The concept of basically, I think, you know, Valve's sort of end game for Steam is to make it a platform that moves beyond PC and moves beyond specific architectures like x86, for example. They just want to be able to run Steam everywhere. And obviously, we're at the situation now where there are sort of mobile devices out there that are doing stuff with Winlator and stuff like that, and FX, in order to make AAA games run on a phone. Now, I don't believe that that's the sort of proper end point, because I don't think a lot of people particularly want to play AAA games on a phone. And if they did, they could stream it, for example, from their main PC or stuff like that. But I think it is more about the sort of diversification of endpoint hardware that will be able to run Steam. And I think the diligence that Valve has put into this has been quite remarkable, because, you know, you think about the original failure of Steam Machine, and, you know, you think, okay, right, Windows forever, but they just kept at it. And now we have a situation where Linux is a perfectly viable way to play the, you know, I'm not going to say the majority, but a vast swathes of the PC library. And now they're kind of beginning formative work to do the same for ARM, which I think is fantastic. Really interesting stuff. I am also, of course, very, very interested to see what the Steam Frame is capable of in terms of those, in terms of the Steam library more generally, not just the VR side, because it is going to be our first official Valve product that is going to be able to play Steam games, right? And games that were never designed for that particular style of hardware. So, yeah, interesting stuff. I mean, Half-Life Alyx, I was all set to play it. I've never actually put any real time into it. I was all set to play it when the PC adapter for the PSVR 2 came along. But I just couldn't get that adapter working at all. So, alas, it is an experience that still eludes me. But, yeah, I enjoyed this particular video. I just like the fact that people try this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? It's fantastic. Now, even if the results are jerky and not particularly great, I just love the fact that people try it. And there's a sort of particular fascination with it that... That makes it pretty cool, right? And kudos for this guy to actually put the time in to get something at least running.
Exactly. It's also interesting that some people noted that it seems like there's some Half-Life Alyx updates incoming. There's been some changeless stuff, and there's like stuff happening back there. Maybe it's just to update things like the controllers and such, official support, but who knows? Like, there is still things happening around that game.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff.
And we've seen a bunch of other recent games receive Steam Frame updates, and I think there's been some that have even received native Steam Frame support already. So, like, developers are busy preparing for that launch, whenever that might be.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully soon, but who knows at this point? Who knows how many they'll even be able to make? Mm-hmm. Crazy stuff. Right, let's move on. Okay, so there was a recent update to the Steam hardware survey and some interesting results and interesting stories that have been birthed from that particular survey. And it's a bit weird, shall we say. There seems to be two specific headlines here that have caught people's attention. Mainly, and I think this is sort of like the most interesting and baffling headline, that 16 gigabyte VRAM GPUs are seemingly accounting for like the biggest majority of a single memory allocation, so to speak. So according to the Steam hardware survey, 25% of the audience have 16 gigabyte GPUs. And this is just bizarre and something that just does not make sense from any kind of perspective. But we'll talk about that in a minute. A second finding is that it was previously the case that it was six physical core CPUs that were kind of like the sweet spot from for the Steam hardware survey. It's kind of like where you'll find the most amount of games machines running six core CPUs. That has now changed to eight core CPUs. That kind of surprises me because, you know, the Ryzen 5s, the whatever the Intel equivalent is to a Core i5 these days, always been like six cores, six physical cores, six main gaming cores. Things seem to be changing there, eight cores. Now, the eight core side of things, I can kind of understand because for two reasons. First of all, there's the rise of the X3D processors, which the vast majority of them are eight core, 16 thread CPUs. That kind of makes sense to me. That's sort of, that does make sense. Similarly, when you look back to AM4 now, the Ryzen 5 5600 six core, that, you know, that seems to be like the sort of default landing place. But it is the case now that, you know, CPUs like the 5700X, the 5800X, they do seem to be quite cheap. You can, you know, you can pop over to AliExpress, for example, and get those CPUs very, very cheaply. So I guess the shift towards eight core CPUs doesn't really surprise me that much, but certainly the concept that 25% of the Steam audience have 16 gigabyte VRAM GPUs, Oliver, this makes no real sense. right?
No, it doesn't make any sense, especially when you look at the market that's kind of being contemplated here, which is a market where 16 gigabyte GPUs would be outselling 8 gigabyte GPUs, which I think anyone with a couple of brain cells to rub together could probably conclude is not likely the case. Especially when, you know, you look at the universe of 16 gigabyte GPUs, we're really just talking about quite high-end NVIDIA fare, quite high-end AMD fare, GPUs like the 5070 Ti and 5080 on the NVIDIA side, and GPUs like the 9070 family on the AMD side, right? Relatively high-end hardware. Doesn't make a lot of sense. I've seen it suggested, I think you suggested earlier to me, actually, that this was caused by the rise of integrated graphics or some accounting issue where maybe some systems with integrated graphics are being counted as having 16 gigabytes of memory, whereas previously they weren't being counted as having 16 gigabytes of memory. Perhaps that's the total addressable memory size. 16 gigabytes is obviously a very common memory size for laptops. So if they're just including all of that as potential VRAM, that could account for it. And that might actually, you know, not be strictly speaking incorrect, but in the spirit of things, that would not really be a 16 gigabyte graphics product, right? Because, you know, even if you have a pretty healthy allocation for graphics, you're not going to have 16 gigabytes for graphics. And even if you do have 16 gigabytes for graphics available, it's going to be pretty slow relative to a discrete GPU. So maybe you just need to cut integrated GPUs out of the picture. I don't know, but it certainly doesn't feel like an accurate accounting of the state of the PC GPU market at the moment to say that 25% of all gamers have, Steam gamers have 16 gigabyte GPUs. I mean, that doesn't seem accurate. On the CPU side of things, you know, I mean, it's encouraging, I guess, but just having 8 CPU cores doesn't tell you very much about the capability of a processor, especially for games which are usually bound by the performance of one or two threads and aren't going to stress an 8 gigabyte, or rather, not an 8 gigabyte, an 8 CPU core CPU too badly, right? 6 CPU cores is perfectly sufficient for a CPU to run games for the most part, as long as you have sufficient cache, sufficient instructions per clock, sufficient, you know, clock speed there. You can get away with 6 CPU cores just fine for the most part. It's more of an artifact of general CPU scaling and not gaming specific CPU scaling, but we see 8 CPU cores become more and more common, right? It's not very important for gaming, in my opinion. So yeah, that's less interesting than the 16 gigabyte figure, but at least it probably does represent a real trend in CPUs towards higher core counts and not some kind of accounting issue with how do we think about integrated graphics and unified memory in the context of a PC platform, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've just been looking over a list of GPUs that do have 16 gigabytes of RAM. And on the NVIDIA side, you know, you're right, it is basically sort of higher end fare. The exception being like the 4060 and the 5060 Ti, yeah. Those had 16 gigabyte variants. Arc, of course, A770, the Intel card had 16 gigabytes of memory. But yeah, NVIDIA side, it is basically like, 4070, actually no, 5070 Ti, 4070 Ti Super. And then it's like, 80 class upwards. So, the concept of two generations of NVIDIA cards basically amounting to what would be a majority of that 25% just doesn't make sense. Obviously, AMD have a rather more storied history of 16 gigabyte cards going back to, primarily RDNA2 with the 6800 class upwards. And then you had, obviously the most recent ones, the 9070, 9070 XT, 9060 XT, 16 gig. But John, just going back to basically my search went back to like 2018. And in 2019, of course, the legendary, always in my background here, the Radeon 7, 16 gigs of HBM2 memory. This thing didn't muck about.
You're right. And in fact, I think what's really happening here, Rich, is that people have been watching DF Direct Weekly and hearing us talk about the Radeon 7 and realize that with the price of RAM today, that the Radeon 7 is the best value in gaming and computer hardware. Like, think about how much you get with that thing.
Yeah.
I hear they even hide some extra RAM in that little red cube on the end.
Crazy stuff. Yeah, but your other favorite AMD GPU, the Fury X, only 4 gigs of HBM memory there. Yeah. Sad artifact from another age.
I know, but that was just a different time. That card would be amazing until you wanted to play, Shadow of Mordor? In which case, then you're screwed because that one's at 6 gig.
Yeah. That was the thing, right? That was back in the day where everyone was kind of shocked that a game would ship requiring 6 gigabytes of RAM, and it was Shadow of Mordor, which made the grade at the end.
I love that because that was one of the first to go high on VRAM requirements, but it also shipped on the triple. And it was horrible.
I think going back to the Steam hardware survey, there's certain things that happen which don't seem explainable, and there's never really any sort of transparency from Valve in terms of explaining why this sort of stuff is happening. So, yeah, sometimes you get these weird spikes, and then they disappear a few months later, where presumably either the sampling has changed or Valve has basically figured out, that's not quite, maybe we need to make a change there. But we don't actually get any sort of explanations for why this sort of stuff's happening. I really wish there was another way for there to be sort of massive sampling of the available gaming audience out there, and to produce some sort of alternative to the Steam hardware survey that's a bit more descriptive. And also kind of like with exposed methodology. I think that would be really, really cool. And we kind of need something like that, because there's nothing like the Steam hardware survey. And I think kind of like the way it's interpreted, sometimes sort of prone to abuse and also misunderstanding. But I suspect that's basically what's happening here, because otherwise it doesn't really make sense. Anyway, let's move on. So we're going to end the show with John telling us about, and I'm just going to quote what he's put on the docket here, retro PC ramblings. I've been up to things. John, what things have you been up to?
Well, recently I got into the NEC PC 98 world.
It's kind
of,
okay.
Which
is that more of an Audi joint?
A little bit, yeah. But someone put one up for sale in a friend group of mine, and I decided to jump on it. It's actually a weird one. It's a late generation PC 98, but it was originally intended as like a home theater PC. So it's the NEC Celeb, I guess. Cereb. It's supposed to be like celebrity, but it has video in and out, and it was designed to play like DVDs. It came with a 28 inch CRT widescreen monitor by default. I did not get that. I don't need that right now. But it's allowed me to sort of like dabble around with some of the various software on there. And it's kind of like this. So the PC 98 is very much uses hardware similar to the IBM PC that we know, but with some slight differences. Sound hardware is quite different, and there's things with the graphics subsystem that's different. But once you get to Windows, PC 98 running Windows 98, for instance, can run normal Windows games by and large. But it's the DOS stuff that's kind of weird, because the DOS, PC 98 DOS games, you can't run the normal MS-DOS stuff. It's different. It is a different operating system, basically. And it allows you to explore kind of like this alternate library of like games that we didn't really see. And, you know, there's RPGs, visual novels, there's platformers. The first five entries of the Toho series is on there. But it's fun to see kind of like what Japanese developers were up to on a platform like this. And obviously being a computer at the time, this was a more expensive thing than consoles. And as a result, there is there's a lot of adult content on there, shall I say.
If
you're looking for that, then you're gonna find it. They like to stick that in there just about everywhere. But there is some interesting stuff. Like I was playing around with the PC 98 version of Police Knots, which is a Kojima game, if you recall, and it got ported to some other platforms. But the 98 version, it has fewer colors available to it, but it runs in like a high res mode, so it's like it has this super sharp look to it, and a lot of PC 98 games go for this, but it's just this beautiful 640 by 480 kind of image quality with that relies heavily on dithering, and it just has like a look and feel to it that's really unique that I quite like. And the internal hardware for sound use on PC 98 What I found is that if you look at Western PC games, games that supported music often used MIDI music, where they would actually use the MIDI standard. They would compose sometimes for like a Roland, but then you would play it on like an Adlib or a Sound Blaster using an OPL2 or OPL3 chip. So you were basically playing, using an FM synth chip to play MIDI music. But PC-98 games, by and large, so many of them seem to have been composed specifically for FM synth, and they can even use samples within it. And by composing for the chip, as opposed to translating MIDI music over, like the quality of the sound you get from this is just nuts. Like, I cannot believe how much better the FM synth in these games sounds compared to what you hear on an IBM PC with those Yamaha chips. Like, I can send an example here to Oliver, but just like, you just listen to this and it's like, holy moly, that's awesome. It's just, it shows that there was like a different focus in terms of development and utilizing the resources differently. Like, so many more of these older games ran in high res mode specifically, so the frame rates aren't always great, but I think they liked to do it because you would get really sharp Japanese characters, and it also enabled a specific type of art. And so, like, music and sound and video wise, it just has a completely different feel from the IBM PC of the same vintage. It's like a different world. So I've enjoyed exploring that, just seeing how it is. And the machine I'm using is actually pretty high end, the PC 98 world, being a Pentium MMX 200 megahertz.
Okay, that's cool.
So, and it's nice to also have a Windows PC that's in that range, because I have a Pentium 3 700 as well that I often use. But I find that for earlier Windows 95 era games, it tends to be a little too fast. So either they don't run or they run too quick. So having a Pentium 200 sort of brings that back down, you know, where games that were more speed sensitive behave more predictably on that, which I like. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's a neat, beautiful little system. It actually came with a wireless keyboard that can function in wired or wireless mode, and the mouse plugs into the keyboard kind of like a Mac. Like, just the way the system is built and the everything's hooked up, it even has an internal speaker, but you can use external. It feels so different compared to what was happening in the IBM PC world. It's really, really just cool to see it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not so much retro, but I was just thinking back based on our discussions earlier too. There was a kind of era where I think the Steam Machine, the initial Steam Machine initiative, there was an attempt to kind of like make some PCs that weren't like traditional PCs. So there's like the Alienware Alpha, which is a very sort of, it was basically laptop parts integrated into a very small sort of PC chassis. And that's really, really cool. We don't really see that sort of, I mean, I guess we do now with Steam Machine, right? The new Steam Machine. But there seemed to be this sort of movement to try and make console-like PCs, which kind of floundered. And I think there was also the Area X51, mm-hmm. which was that kind of Xbox 360 type mini tower. I'd love to see the return of those if there is this sort of concerted drive to bring PCs, PC gaming and Steam OS into the living room. But it's just a shame that those sort of devices aren't made anymore, and the devices that are out there in terms of, like, I guess they do have some sort of interesting value, but they are, of course, very much locked to the games of their time. They wouldn't run anything, practically anything modern today. But yeah, interesting nonetheless. You were talking earlier about the Rendition Verite. Yeah. And you said you were going to mention something, John.
So that's another thing is, well, first of all, on the PC-98, I actually did slap in one of my 3DFX Voodoo cards that I had spare, and I was surprised it actually works, which is cool.
Right.
You can actually use that on a PC-98, as long as you have a system with PCI, because older PC-98s had their own special bus that's not PCI or ISA, but this newer one does have PCI slots. But on the Verite side, just it shows you what kind of fun you can have in retro computing. And I said, what if I put Windows 95 on this system instead of Windows 98 on my normal PC, retro PC? Because I actually found the old Windows 95 disk from my PC from 1997. I just found it floating around. So I decided to install 95 instead of 98 on my P3. And one of the first things I realized is like the Pentium 3 era of hardware is perhaps just a bit too new, and things were a little bit more annoying than I thought. But I did actually get USB support working on Windows 95, so I can use a USB flash drive on there, which is kind of funny, making it probably one of the oldest operating systems where you can actually do that. But I needed a 2D graphics card that I had drivers for, because I couldn't get USB working initially. So I slapped in the Verite, because I actually have the install disk for the Verite drivers that came with it. And I was able to get it running, and I was playing around with stuff. And I realized, like, I was trying out some Windows 95 stuff to test sound and video performance. And I put in stuff like Pitfall and Sonic CD, just like 2D games. And they ran horrible. I was surprised. I was like, what is going on? Why are they so choppy? Like, this is weird. And then I thought, wait a minute, it's the Verite, isn't it? I'd always heard it wasn't great in 2D. And so I found a different video card where I also had the disc handy, which was an ATI Rage 128 Pro. You know, we're living high here, which is a much newer card, by the way. But still, it's 2D performance. It's like night and day. Just put that in, wow. And it ran great. But even older stuff, like if you have like an S3 Trio or something, I think you'll get better than the Verite. The Verite just really seems to struggle with 2D acceleration, and I'm not sure. I haven't actually looked into why, but any like normal 2D games just really seem to struggle on that card, making it kind of difficult to put in a retro build and leave it, because unlike the Voodoo that would follow, it is not a pass-through card. It is a full standalone thing. So
sounds more like 2D deceleration.
Yeah, it's like the inverse of the S3 Verge, which was the 3D decelerator, but really good at 2D. This thing is great at 3D, but horrible at 2D. I also have a rendition Verite V2200 lying around. I didn't have the drivers handy, so I didn't test that. I'm curious now if that actually runs 2D stuff better. I suspect it might.
Interesting. Okay, right. Well, that was our final news topic, or a topic, for this particular edition of DF2Et Weekly. We'll be back soon with our Q&A show, and we're going to be talking about the 1 year of independence of Digital Foundry. It has been one calendar year since we waved goodbye to our friends at Gamer Network and IGN and went our own way. We'll be talking about the good, the bad, and stuff that we want to do going forward, stuff we've achieved, some of the new tooling we've done, lots of interesting stuff happening there. So please do look out for that particular video. But that's all for this one. So yeah, please do like, subscribe, share, all of that sort of stuff, bells, all whether you ring them or not, I'm not sure it makes any difference at this point, but it is there. Patreon.com/Digital Foundry, support Digital Foundry. That does make a difference. But that's all from us on this one. So yeah, thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry.